buying a home? Don't panic. Just listen to the rest of this podcast. Welcome to Home Inspection Authority Straight Talk Podcast with me, John LaForme. Are you a home buyer, a realtor, or maybe a home inspector? If you are, then this podcast is definitely for you. So let's get right into some straight talk about home inspections. Okay, welcome back, everybody. Another episode for you here, episode 8. Today we're going to talk about the CREA Standards of Practice. So who better to call and talk about this than the one and only Bud Hayes, who's been doing inspections a lot longer than I have and has a really, really good understanding of what the CREA standards are. So give me a second here, and I'll just introduce Bud. How you doing, Bud?
Doing good. Thank you for inviting me.
No problem, man. Bud and I have been to many CREA meetings together. We've done some inspections together over the years, and we've always had a good rapport with each other, so I thought he'd be a good guest here today to explain this whole CREA thing and the standards of practice. So Bud, just give me a little info on, what's the standards of practice all about to you?
Well, first of all, I'm sure your guests or the viewers understand, but CREA stands for California Real Estate Inspection Association. The basic background on CREA is that somewhere in the 80s, the law changed for real estate brokers and agents that they should get home inspectors done. And so that's about when CREA developed. There are some home inspectors at that time, but as CREA developed, they go, we really need to get down what our standards are.
Right.
So a lot of work went into a lot of really good inspectors developing this, all of the standards.
Checklist.
Yes.
So the standards of practice is basically a checklist for home inspectors. So here's a good scenario I came up with as to why it's important to have this. Okay. Let's say you go to work tomorrow and all of a sudden your software company goes down and you don't even have a paper written report on standby. You have nothing with you. And then you're like, well, wait a second. Let me just go to the CREA site. I can grab the standards of practice and I can use that as my report template just to follow something, just so I don't miss anything. So I think that's a great thing to think of as a backup in the event your software goes down and you have no written paper report. I don't know anybody that carries a paper report anymore, but if you really had to, I guess you could use this if you got stuck in a jam, took a lot of photos and just followed the standards, and then you wouldn't forget anything.
Well, that would definitely give you a good outline.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, most report software gets much more detailed on all.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Just the things about the water heater, there's probably 18 things to report on. And
right. So, and we're going to get into that today.
Okay. So I think the first thing that I'd say most of my clients, if they've never had an inspection done before, they don't realize exactly what I'm doing there.
Exactly.
And so whatever their conception is. So if you want me to, I could read part like these parts of the.
You mean the definitions and scope?
Well, the A, B, and C. Well, A, B, C, D, and E, and F.
Yeah, that's a good idea, actually. That's a good idea.
So the first paragraph is pretty good. It's home inspection is a non-invasive visual survey and basic operation of the systems and components of a home, which can be reached, entered, or viewed without difficulty, moving obstructions, or requiring any action which may result in damage to the property or personal injury to the inspector. The purpose of the inspection is to provide the client with information regarding the general condition of the building, to assist client in determining what further evaluation, inspection, and repair estimates clients should perform or obtain prior to the release of contingencies.
All right. So let me jump in here.
Sure.
This last sentence that you just said, client with information regarding the general condition of the building to assist client in determining what further evaluation, inspection, and repair estimates client should perform or obtain prior to the release of contingencies. Yes. That is a really, really important sentence right there. That is something most of our clients don't get. They think we're going to come there and give them a price sheet on everything and tell them what it's going to cost. And this, so this sentence to me is one of the most important ones. So let them know at the end of the inspection, hey, look, you know what? I saw a lot of electrical safety hazards here. You need to get an electrician here now before the end of your inspection contingency period and before you close escrow to take a look at this and let you know what it's going to cost to fix all this. So that's the importance of that sentence, our direction to the client when we're done.
That exactly. Like a lot of times what I explain to my clients is I'm similar to your primary care physician giving a general checkup. I'm going to go through all the basic systems, and if I see problems that I think needs further evaluation, you know, that's my basic job.
Right, right. If you need an eye doctor next, you know.
Yeah, and sometimes I can still tell, well, this is a minor repair, but it needs to be looked at, or it's major, or this is significant and possibly needs to get all replaced. I mean, I kind of categorize sure. it yeah. to that for them. So
that's good.
You know, do you want to hire a electrician to come out and look at, reevaluate the property for a few hundred dollars just to fix that one outlet?
Right.
So, but the client needs to make that decision.
Yes. You're just giving them the facts.
Yeah.
That's it. You want me to read B? You want
to read? Yeah, yeah, go for it.
All right, I'm going to read paragraph B. A home inspection report provides written documentation of material defects discovered in the inspected building systems and components, which, in the opinion of the inspector, are safety hazards, are not functioning properly, or appear to be at the end of their serviceable lives. The report may include the inspector's recommendations for correction or further evaluation. Once again, the report may include the inspector's recommendations for correction or further evaluation. Those are the important things that the customer needs to grasp and really, okay, I get it. You're here to tell me, now I need, you point me in the right direction. You're telling me I need to get this looked at further and this looked at further. Okay, Mr. Inspector, I understand.
Right. One thing I wanted to just point out here is the definition of material defect. So material basically means important or significant. So sometimes people, anyway, that's that part of it. And then it says the inspector's recommendations for corrections at the end of this. So now this is where I've had a lot of people tell me, don't give them specific recommendations. You know, it's not the inspector to go, oh, your deck is leaking and you need to fix this section. And if they fix that and it's still leaking, it might be other places too. So you have to be very careful on your recommendation. The recommendation should be, let's have, you know, general contractor that's experienced or with decks.
Qualified professional.
Yes. Qualified professional, not Uncle Harry.
Yeah, or Uncle Bob.
Yeah.
I've been seeing a lot of his work lately.
So that would be our recommendations. A lot of times people tell me, well, how do I fix that and so forth? And I go, well, this is my opinion, but we need further evaluation in order to really accurately repair or replace that item.
Exactly. Yep.
So you want to go to C?
All right. Paragraph C. All further evaluation, inspection, and repair work needs to be provided by competent and qualified professionals who are licensed and or certified. Once again, another important one.
That's very important. And of course, what I think we both run into, we go out and do an inspection and we have a list of 20 or 30 items that need correction. And then they call you back in a couple of weeks. I want you to come out and reevaluate this or check if there's repairs. And you go, okay, well, the first thing they're supposed to have is copies of work orders and receipts.
This thing called an invoice.
Yeah. And most of the time they don't. So you don't know who fixed it.
So what you're referring to is a re-inspection.
Yes.
Okay. So let's talk about that real quick while we're on the subject.
Okay.
So re-inspections to me, I stopped doing re-inspections years ago for that exact reason. Every time I went back, nothing was done correctly. Nothing was done by a professional. There was no receipts. And I just felt like my client was getting screwed. You know what I mean? Like no one did anything to the house. I literally went back on a couple houses. Nothing was changed. And they told the buyers.
Everything was fixed.
Everything was fixed. And I just look at the buyer. I feel bad for him. I'm like, wow, I'm really sorry I have to tell you this, but nothing at all has been touched in this house. And then as you dig a little further, oh, well, the electrician fixed this part. I'm like, oh, the electrician? So he was a licensed electrician? And I always trip him up.
Yeah.
I love tripping him up. It's just about which question to, you just got to know which question to ask them. And they kind of take the bite debate and they fall on their face with that. So I stopped doing them for that reason because, I try to really emphasize to the customer is you need to have these repairs done by qualified people, people who are insured, people who actually have a business. You know, so
that's true.
And that's what happens. So I always try to really push that. Don't call a handyman to do your electrical work. If you need a doorknob change, call a handyman. That's fine. You need some molding put around your baseboards that put on or whatever. Just that stuff you call a handyman for.
Right.
So I really push that hard and hopefully they listen. A lot of times they do. And they'll ask me to come back and do reinspections. I'll only do that if the gas was off or maybe the water was off. I'll go back for that because I can actually do something then.
Yeah, well, that's more of a completion inspection then.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So you want to call D?
Sure, D. Client should consider all available information when negotiating regarding the property.
That's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
You know, That's the purpose of hiring us, to give you information so you can act on it.
That does remind me. That's one thing I do when it's inside the city of LA. I can get on LA DBS website, which is Department of Building and Safety, and you can check for the online permits.
Okay, yeah.
So building permits. So mm-hmm. A lot of times I will, now not all permits get properly transmitted onto
right.
the website. But a lot of times it'll tell me a good clue, like, you know, what's the history? And I, you know,
yeah,
a 60, 70 year old house. So there's no other permits after the original construction. You go, okay, something's going on. What about this addition? And
yeah. You
know. So I almost always recommend to check for any of the permits. If it's outside of the city of LA, there's not very good resources.
Right.
You have to go to the Department of Building and Safety, you know, for that city or municipality. But anyway, that would be under all available information.
Right. So what I do when I see an upgrade, I call it out. Water heater upgrade present, check with seller regarding permitted installation. Same with a foundation, same with attic framing, same with heating and cooling. Electrical upgrade. I check that off when I see it, just so to make them aware that a permit should have been pulled for these types of repairs and replacements.
Well, good.
That's a tip for all home inspectors. I hope you're all doing that because I think it's very important. It's part of you giving your customer all the facts.
Now we're doing the residential standards of practices here.
Right.
Which is four or fewer units.
Correct.
So once it becomes five units on a property, then it's classified as commercial
right.
property. But if there's a triplex or a fourplex, some of my clients are investors that are buying it for,
right.
you know, they're not living in it for their single, you know, their basic primary house.
Right.
So, all that available information. I do a lot of litigation inspections. So
okay.
tenant-landlord disputes. So one of the biggest problems you can run into is if you have a rental unit, you know, they converted the garage without a permit and you're putting somebody in that house, there's a tremendous amount of liability you have. So, and if there's any dispute between the tenant and landlord, you know, the tenant that occupies an unpermitted unit just wins automatically.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah.
So
in the state of California, absolutely.
Yeah. I've seen guys get, you know, free rent for 6 or 12 months and, you know, just all kinds of stuff.
That's a whole other episode right there.
Yeah. But this is all under the all available information here. So
yeah.
Check out the history, what's going on with the property.
Right. Yeah. When in doubt, call it out. It's, yeah. it's just a simple thing. If you think there's an upgrade, but you're not quite sure, it's better to call it out and bring attention to it than ignore it. But we're going to get really in depth on, exclusions from home inspections later. Yes. Let's get into, you ready to move on to the standards?
Yeah, there's a couple other items here. E and F, I think.
Okay. I thought you went hard through that already. Okay. Oh,
E is inspections performed in accordance with these standards of practice and are not technically exhaustive and shall not apply to the primary building.
It shall apply.
Oh, and excuse me, and shall apply to the primary building and to its associated primary parking structure. Okay. So there's a bunch of things in here. So for instance, a shed in the backyard is not part of that.
Horse stables.
Technically, right. Or if they want us to inspect it, it would be an additional outbuilding inspection, maybe.
Right. An ADU, auxiliary right. dwelling unit. If sure, you show yes. up at the property and they didn't tell you, oh, by the way, there's an extra living area. Well, if you want to inspect it, that'll be more money, number one. But it's a additional structure, so it's not required to do it.
That's right. So I think that pretty well speaks for itself.
Well, I want to get into that a little bit more.
Okay.
So gas pits, gas okay. pit.
Yeah.
Another thing that is not to be expected as part of a home inspection, as far as my business goes, that's how yeah. I run my business. And, outdoor barbecues,
yeah,
stuff like that. You know, I'm going to take a look and see if there's a gas line going to it. You know, I'll check the GFCI, make sure there's GFCI receptacles around it. Just make sure it's safe. Right. But I'm not going to be trying to fire up your grill. I'm not going to be trying to light your gas pit. I'm not going to do your swimming pool either. The swimming pool, we're required to check out safety issues, but we're not required to inspect your swimming pool.
That's correct. Yeah, it's a whole different standard than what's on these.
Right. So there are a lot of limitations to the home inspection as well, and so we're covering both of those right now.
I'm not sure. Does it?
Yeah, it's in there.
It is. And the pool safety.
Yeah. We're going to get to that.
Okay.
We may not get to that today, but we may get that to another episode. So
I should add something. I know outdoor barbecues are usually exterior, a different gas line, a whole different components. And the multi-inspector company I used to work for, they said, oh, we don't have to do that. But right. I usually would. And right. one time out of 100 that I didn't, for some reason, the customer called in and complained, and I had to drive back out. And I go, oh, man, I knew I should have looked at that. Because that's a concern of theirs. So
yeah.
But
Now, I understand different companies do different things. So once again, the CREA standards of practice is a just a guide. As a business owner, we have to make decisions on what we want to do. But at the same time, if there's something in the standards that a certain company doesn't want to do, they're going to make the client aware of that before the job. You know, it's going to be in their inspection agreement. Yeah, I mean, I do. If there's something I know I'm not going to look at, it's called out right away. Client, if they ask me what I'm going to do, I explain everything and I tell them what I'm not going to do as well. So it's really important that you cover all those bases. So like I said, the standards of practice is a guide for you to follow and try not to fall off.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that goes back to the beginning thing we were talking about of, you know, it can't be reached, entered, or viewed without difficulty, et cetera. So, you know,
limitations.
There's some limitations.
Limitations are just as important to write up as a defect. You have to let people know what you could not look at or what you could not test.
Right.
So that you don't look like you're incompetent later because, oh, why didn't you tell me you didn't do that? Well, oh, I forgot.
The guy's expensive sports car parked in the garage and the garage attic hatch is right above his car. And
right.
It's like, no, I'm not going to.
Ain't worth it.
Yeah.
Don't try to be the hero. Don't put a piece of carpet on top of his car and then stand on it.
Yeah.
Not a good idea.
But I will take a picture and put it in a report.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a Lamborghini here. It's a really nice one, but they wouldn't let me drive it. So I couldn't back it up. So, okay. So yeah, there's going to be a lot of limitations, but I think as we get into each section, Bud, we can go in detail on each section's limitations.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So, okay. Part two is standards of practice. Let's see. A home inspection includes the readily accessible systems and components or a representative number of multiple similar components listed in sections 1-9. Subject to limitations, exceptions, and exclusions in part three. Okay, so let me put a little light on that. So for example, I'm sure the house you're looking at is going to have more than one wall receptacle. So if the home is furnished, we can't reach every receptacle because they'll be behind couches, they'll be behind armoires, the dresser, whatever. There's going to be a very limited amount that we can actually get to. So that's what this is describing here. Multiple similar components, a representative amount of multiple similar components. That's what that means. So it means that we're not going to be able to check every single thing if there's a limit, if there's a restriction there or a furniture or whatever.
Absolutely. I did one in a condo the other day that the lady had every outlet things plugged into it. Almost every outlet. It's like, I'm not going to go around and start unplugging her electronic equipment and chargers and alarm clocks. So that would be a limitation. That would be a nice courtesy.
Yeah. Keep in mind, home buyers, when you hire us, you haven't bought the house yet.
Yeah.
So if someone else lives there, we're not going to go unplug their favorite electric toothbrush. Because they get upset over those things. We're not going to disconnect their alarm clocks because they get upset over those things. And they'll call us and yell at us. So, yeah, we're not going to do those things. So that's why there's limitations when you're buying a home, especially if it's still occupied.
Okay. So you want to go into the first section here about foundations?
Yeah.
So foundation, basement, and underfloor areas.
You mean crawl spaces, right?
That could be, yes, if it's a raised foundation.
Correct, yeah.
I think they use the word just underfloor areas as a good general.
Sure.
Whatever. So A, items to be inspected. 1, foundation system. You want me to read through all these and we can go back over them? Or?
No, let's just do one at a time.
Okay.
We'll just cover it.
So foundation system. So you know, what comes to mind to me is, you know, basically we're going to either have a raised foundation, which is either going to be, you know, concrete or concrete blocks, maybe bricks, but, you know, on the perimeter of the house, it supports the house. And so that would be a raised foundation where hopefully you can crawl underneath.
Mm-hmm. 16 by 24, right?
Yeah.
That's the size it's supposed to be anyway. Not at some of the houses we go to.
Yeah. And I'd have to pull out the codes to see what the exact height clearance is. But right. A lot of times I can look underneath and go, I can't go right. more than 8 feet.
Yeah.
So I'll take pictures from here. But that's a reportable item. Then.
Right.
You know, that, hey, there's poor access. That means any work that you have under.
That means no one's going under there.
Yeah.
If you can't get under and no one's, it's just completely blocked up or whatever. I mean, chances are no one's been in there in quite some time.
Right. So that means any repairs needed in that area are going to be a lot more expensive.
Yes. They're going to have to trench it out, dig it out to get people in there. Buckets.
Yeah. And so that would be the one system. And then I usually just in general just say a slab. There's different types of slabs, but that's where the concrete is just on the dirt. And there's no crawl space.
Right.
It's just ground underneath.
Slab on earth. Yep.
Yeah.
So the limitations for what Bud's talking about is really important to write up as a home inspector. If let's say you were able to get in, I don't know, under the master, you were able to access under the master bedroom, but not the master bathroom. What's more important? I'd say the bathroom is more important to get under.
Yeah.
So you want to call out and make sure your report states that you had a limitation in that crawl space. You could not get past a certain point to check the plumbing, and it needs to be further evaluated before your inspection contingency is over.
I'd like to add something here. Like, this is the first section on the standards, but usually the foundation is the last thing that I look at.
Correct.
So, because I personally like to walk through the house and around the house, and I'm looking for any areas where, you know, stress cracks, settlement cracks, doors rubbing, floors are a little wonky. So any of those things, I kind of keep that in mind. So when I go underneath, I can look in those areas and
sure.
see.
Yeah.
See what's happening.
I agree. Yeah, that's a good, it's a good practice. So let's talk about the floor framing system.
Okay.
Now, awesome. Well, what's the difference, Mr. Inspector? The foundation of the floor framing system. Most people have a hard time with that. Most customers don't differentiate that. They think anything underneath the house is the foundation. Mm-hmm. Technically, I guess you could say it is.
Foundation area, but.
Right. So really. A foundation that we're referring to is something like a poured concrete foundation or concrete block, which is typically on the perimeter, unless you have a lot of stem walls in the middle of the house. Like 1950s homes typically have a lot of staggered stem walls
right.
underneath in between the perimeters that you crawl around, and there's no post and piers. So,
you know, that's interesting. So let's just spend a minute on that, because okay. usually the perimeter foundation is a solid that goes around that house. And then in the middle, a stem wall is where it's a full height concrete wall that goes from dirt up to the floor. So
yep.
it's similar to the perimeter foundation. Then they usually have these gaps or little doorways.
Yeah, little openings so you can get through.
Little cells that you can get through. Most, which is really a good system.
I like that system.
It's a lot more sturdy and so forth.
And the floor joists run from one to the other.
Yeah. So it holds better with earthquakes. And then if there's minor settlement, it's usually not as big of an issue. Now, the other way is what's called a post and pier support, which is a wood post, usually about a 4x4 that sits on a concrete pier block. And so those are just scattered all the way
right.
running along the floor joists and stuff underneath. So now the advantage of that is that the space is a lot more open, so air ventilates easier.
Sure.
The stem walls sometimes will restrict airflow, but the weak part of that is they're not as sturdy under earthquake.
Right.
And if you have a plumbing leak somewhere, you know, dirt gets muddy, these things get soft, and they
could sink.
Sink down.
Now you get floor deflection.
And I remember the house that we inspected with your robot. We had inflection. I thought, well, I wonder if that's what happened. We get down there with the crawl bot, and that's what had happened.
Yep.
At one post, it settled by the bathtub leak or something. I'm just looking down the list here. So this would technically, those Post and peer supports or additional bracing would probably be part of the foundation system here by this.
Yeah, it is there. It's under number 4. Foundation anchoring. I'm sorry. No, it's going to be floor. Yeah, floor. That'd be under floor framing, the post and piers.
Okay.
Yeah, that, I would definitely call that under. That's where I have it. That's where I have it in my report under floor framing. Because it, technically, you know, it's all wood until you get to the concrete pier.
Yeah. I usually just have it separate anyway. So.
Right. So that's, I mean, that's going to be decided between each person who makes the report. If you make your own, well, you do what you want.
Yeah. And then the next section here, number 3, is under floor ventilation. So that's a very good one.
Hang on 1 second. Let's get back to that in a second. Okay. There's still more to talk about on number 2 under floor framing.
Okay.
All right. So back to floor framing system for a second. Another thing we're looking at on the floor framing is any wood damage. Has there been any? Is there an active leak that might have damaged a bunch of wood? Is there actually wet conditions under there from an active leak? Is there what looks like it might be a termite? Wood destroying organisms causing wood damage. There's a lot of things we're looking at under there as far as the floor framing system goes.
Understood. I'm not sure if this is a good time to talk about the difference between our inspection and a termite or pest control operator inspection.
Well, we can mention that now.
Yeah. Okay. Because what we're looking for is anything that is structurally compromised or, you know, adversely affecting the structure. So the termite report usually is looking for wood destroying organisms, which includes termites or fungus, rotted wood.
Yep.
So now, of course, if I see rotted wood, I go, hey, that's not good because that is, you know, weakening the structural support of the framing.
Integrity, yep.
If I see live termites under there, I'm not a termite inspector.
I just call it wood damage. I saw some wood damage. Needs to be further evaluated.
Yeah, sometimes I take a picture.
Yep. Put that in the report.
Yeah.
There you go.
But there's... Now, this is one reason why I like to walk around the house and do my interiors before I get underneath. Because if you find little places where the floor is... going weird, you know, there again, going weird or
deflection,
cracks,
yeah.
Or deflections.
Or, walking uphill, walking downhill.
And so then when I go underneath the house, I can look closer at those areas to see what's going on.
Sure. Yeah.
So I could talk more, but I think that pretty much covers it.
Okay. And let's see. Okay. So once again, limitations. Limitations for the foundation, basement, and underfloor areas is kind of all in one. So if you, for example, cannot get under the house at all, then you cannot comment on the foundation's condition. You cannot comment on the floor framing condition. You cannot comment on the underfloor ventilation condition. You cannot comment on foundation anchoring unless you can see them through the underfloor ventilation holes.
Yeah.
The outside walls. If you see some anchoring, you could say, okay, I saw some anchoring. We're not required to count how many bolts there are or tell you if they're properly spaced or anything like that. So
depends on the year of the construction,
right,
too. So.
Right. So if it's a 1920s house, chances are there's not a bolt there to begin with unless someone's retrofitted it. So with that being said, once again, limitations is important. So wood separation from soil, another thing you cannot comment on because you could not look under there. So if you cannot get under the house on a raised foundation, you have to call out all these things that you could not see. I want to be clear on that.
Yes. And that would require an approved, qualified, you know, specialist to make access available, give recommendations how to dig out or
right
to access it, et cetera. So,
yeah, I guess I've been in a lot of crawl spaces where there's actually no access to one area. And if you're not really paying attention, you could walk right by it.
Yeah.
And not even realize, oh shit, there's a spot right here. And then you get home and you're looking at the report and you're going through all your pictures later. You're like, wait a second, I went around this way. I went through, what's this? How come I couldn't see this area? So it's not too late. You know, report's not done yet. So yeah. You just go, you know what? I couldn't see under this area. Sometimes those things happen.
Yes.
You get spun around. You don't forget where you are underneath. You're like, where am I? So there's little things that can happen like that. So just like I said, it's really important, and I want to stress this about every part of the standards of practice. You have to write up what you could not inspect. It's just as important as what you did inspect. That's a learning lesson for anybody doing this.
Yeah. Well, that's the old observe and report.
Yeah.
You know, so if you see that, then you report on it.
So correct.
If you can't get in underneath the house for some reason, you better explain why you can't, and as it is a disclaimer.
And I would definitely let them know that as soon as possible before you leave, hopefully.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, don't wait. Unless you, like I just said, you didn't realize there was a spot you couldn't get to until later. Understood. But if it's obvious, tell them right away before you leave the inspection so they can get it taken care of right away. Okay, so underfloor ventilation, bud, go.
Oh, this is, I think this is, it really depends on the geology of the house, but I think this sometimes is extremely critical.
Correct, I agree. And
so I did one inspection in a house up in, well, Canoga Park up in, where all the rocks are, and they had no ventilation.
Right.
But it's high, it's really dry, one access door, you know, it looked okay, smelled okay. I go out during heavy rains, there's a lot of natural moisture vapors that come up out of the ground, and you need those screens around the house to allow that excess humidity build up to evacuate.
Yeah.
So, but most houses that are on flat or anywhere in the valley, if you have limited ventilation, that's going to just stack up the humidity inside. And whenever you get a high humidity, then that allows bacteria, fungus, and different kinds of molds to grow. The musty odors, sometimes you can smell them inside the house coming up through the floor. Boards.
Yep.
So you've got to have good ventilation underneath the house to prevent mold.
Yeah. It's going to prevent a whole bunch of adverse conditions if you don't have good ventilation. As soon as you have one leak and you have no ventilation, it's just like a recipe for disaster as far as your wood goes. You'll start getting settlement issues. You can get all kinds of stuff going on once you get a leak.
Yeah.
If you have moisture coming in from the outside already,
well, that'll
the
just,
perimeter,
you know, exasperate it or make it worse.
Yeah.
So, I'm going to say it's actually fairly common that I'll run into poor ventilation.
Same here.
You know?
Yeah.
So I better give them a heads up. And of course, this kind of time of year when it hasn't rained for 6 months, you're not sure what the condition is when it starts raining. Where's the water table? How much humidity and dampness is going to come up? If you have really poor ventilation, you can actually get it so that the ground gets wet. If you have better ventilation, then it never, you know, it'll keep drying out.
Right, right.
So,
And I see this a lot in brand new houses, brand new construction with a crawl space, one or two vents. And I'm like, oh, I got to tell these people this. I hate it being put in that position. Why wasn't this done right? And there's insulation everywhere under there. And there's no ventilation. There's a couple crawl space accesses. That's all they have. I'm like, how'd they get away with this? Interesting.
If you're like me, you're walking around, oh, nice new house, the front and the side, and you get somewhere. There's two vents on this side and there's a patio in the back, and
Yeah. It's
like, you know,
right.
They just don't have enough vents.
It's not enough. Happens a lot.
Okay, so this other one, the wood separation from...
Oh, no, you got to do number four. Foundation anchoring and wall bracing.
Excuse me.
All right, I'll take that one then.
Yeah.
Okay, number four. Foundation anchoring and cripple wall bracing. What does that mean? Well, the foundation anchoring is pretty straightforward. Most customers are going to ask, hey, is my house bolted? That's what they mean, anchored. Yeah. Is it anchored? Well, it's good to know this if you're able to get under the house. But if it's a slab foundation and it's a newer building from, like, let's say the 90s forward or something like that, you may have a hard time determining that unless you happen to look inside the return plenum. You may see some bolts in the return plenum.
Oh.
If you haven't tried that, it's a good place to look. The return plenum may show them, and if the garage doesn't have drywall, you could probably check in there too, but most of them are going to have drywall around that time. So foundation anchoring. Yes, we want to be able to tell the customers, is there any visible anchoring? If you do not see any, then just let them know it's probably concealed in the walls depending on what year the house is built.
Right.
So that's something you don't want to forget to mention. If you couldn't see it, but hey, if the house is built in the 80s, if the house is built in the 70s, the house is built in the 60s, the house is built in the 50s, the house is built in the 40s, I think you're pretty safe to say there's going to be a couple bolts there.
Right.
But chances that there is a possibility there may not be in like a late 30s or early 30s and new and older than that. So 1920s for sure.
Yeah, so 1933, that was a Long Beach earthquake that changed the codes for bolting and reinforced brick. So after 1933, all brick buildings had to have reinforcement bar in them. Chimneys had to have reinforcement rebar in them. And the structures had to be bolted. But in 1933, my experience is they just kind of put them wherever they felt like every 6 to 15 feet. And then the codes have increased. Now they're supposed to be within 6 inches of both sides of the corner and every six feet. And they're much more highly engineered.
Yeah. Back then, if Joe's Construction was doing your house, they may put them every 4 feet. You know, Steve's Construction might put them once every 16 feet.
Right.
And, you know, there wasn't enough oversight then to really put a finger on them.
So this is different, but I know some insurance companies, when clients are filling out their form, they'll have, the insurance questionnaire that usually has to be done by a general contractor. So, and one of the questions is, you know, how frequent are the spacing of the bolts? So the guy will actually get in there and evaluate it.
Sure.
But in general, if it's bolted, it's bolted.
Right.
You know? The next part, I think, is a little bit more important for the earthquake safety.
I want to mention one more thing on the foundation anchoring. This just happened with me about a week and a half ago. I went and inspected this house down by Playa and in California, down by Playa del Rey. And this house had an excessive amount of moisture, to the point where it was damaging the inner raised stem wall. So much moisture get into that section of foundation. It got a hold of the rebar. The rebar expanded and rusted, and it broke apart. There was like a 10-foot crack and a horizontal crack.
Right.
Running down this, I don't know what, 18-inch stem wall. So... And the reason why I mention that is because, of course, when I was under there, I did notice that there was bolting. And so I confirmed there was bolting on the property. And the house was built in the 60s. So I had no question that there was going to be bolts.
Right.
But I just wanted to make sure I visibly saw one or two somewhere. And I just looked in the vents, and I saw, I think I counted 7 or 8.
Oh.
But I came back a few days later because they wanted me to come back and do a mold inspection on the same house. And then they go, oh, by the way, the foundation guy said there's no bolts. I'm like, really? Follow me. Grabbed the flashlight. I showed him. He went, wow. I said, So that's a good point for everybody. If there's a foundation guy there and he's saying, oh, there's no anchoring, you still want to take a look yourself. Secondhand information can get you in trouble. So be a little careful with that. I'd have been shocked if I was there and the guy said that right in front of me. I was like, well, what are you talking about, man? There's seven of them right here.
Yeah.
So just be careful with that.
Yeah. So a lot of people don't really understand. Most people, I'd say, don't understand what a cripple wall is.
Correct. Yeah.
So there's diagrams that you can look online, but basically, you know, there's the perimeter foundation is concrete, let's say. And then there's this, above the foundation is the floor framing. So there's anywhere from what can be 12 to 24 inches of short little walls that go from the foundation up to the floor frame. So that's what's called a cripple wall. The problem with earthquake on that is that when the whole house shifts, these are kind of like hinged walls. So that's where if you know, they'll bend and sway. If you ever look at pictures of houses that are earthquake damaged, sometimes they're like, you know, yeah, it collapsed on one side and it fell down to the ground.
Right.
And so cripple wall bracing is where they come in on an older structure and they add plywood for shear panel strength to keep those more rigid. And of course, modern construction, that's the code, is that you have to have plywood for shear panel strength.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Cripple wall bracing is kind of hard to explain on a podcast. So if you're in front of a computer, just like look it up, cripple wall, CRIPPLE, then wall bracing. And just look up some images of it. You'll get a better idea what we're talking about. It's really hard to explain unless you're really familiar with this stuff. So yeah, cripple wall bracing is something you want to point out. A lot of older homes that have never been retrofitted, you know, they need it, you know. And you want to let your customer know that. There's probably no anchoring anyway. In most cases, there's no anchoring along those lines too.
Well, sometimes on an older house, I like it not just for earthquake, but it just seems like it strengthens the whole structure.
Sure.
So for any minor settlement, it's going to hold up better to it.
It's definitely a worthwhile upgrade. Yeah. I would recommend that to everybody. If you got cripple walls, get them braced. If you don't have anchoring, get your anchoring put in. It's just a no-brainer. You know, if the house shakes enough, you're going to have cracks everywhere. Like Bud mentioned, you can get, you know, some settlement from it, and it's just going to stiffen up your structure.
Right. I'd like to also make a comment that very seldom do I see that they've, in the city of LA, they have what are called LA standards for retrofitting, which is basically has been adopted for most of the state. But if you've ever seen those, they're like four pages of blueprints. Lots of diagrams and specifications, and there's special kind of brackets that you have to add the anchor bolts to, and then add the cripple walls, a special way to put the shear panels onto that. And there's other little brackets and braces that you're supposed to add, so it's all stitched together.
Yeah, no, there's a process to it, and it's engineered.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about engineering, there's a specific bolt that has to be a specific amount of inches away from the next one and so forth. So that's why, you know, when you get a retrofitter out there, they're going to look at that a certain way. They're licensed contractors to do this, right?
Yes.
So they know how to approach this, how to measure it out, how to figure out what goes where and why. That's not something a home inspector is necessarily going to know. So don't get mad at him if he doesn't know all those specs, because we don't do the work.
No, but sometimes I will mention that, you know, it's been retrofitted, but it doesn't appear to be up to current standards.
Right.
Let them know, you know, it's still an improvement, but it's not, probably not to code.
Not the latest version of it.
Yeah, so that's a good point, because the latest version of the LA standards came out in 95 after the Northridge.
Yeah, that was a disaster, yeah.
So, Well, this is where you just need to get an approved professional. But quite often the building inspectors don't crawl underneath the house to examine and check off that the guy did it correctly.
Don't they call that a drive-by?
Yeah.
All right, so we're still in the foundation, basement, and underfloor area section of the CREA Standards of Practice. So now I want to mention wood separation from soil. What does that mean? And what is the big deal? And who do you call? Here's a good question for you, bud.
Okay.
Make believe I'm not an inspector. I'm just going to ask you a question. So who do I call to move my dirt?
Well, I think it's kind of a common sense thing, like how much and so forth. And, you know, now that should come up in the termite inspection also as a section two damage, any wood to dirt contact. So that allows termites to enter soil in contact with dirt. If it's wet, then it's going to transfer and cause rotted wood.
Right.
It's usually just kind of a reflection of poor workmanship done in the past.
Yeah, I know. When they ask me who do they call for that, I'm like, you know, that's a really good question. I think you can just send your kid under there with a pail and a little shovel. Maybe he can clean it up for you. No, I'm just kidding.
But you know, it's hard to say, man. But you know, if it's a, you know,
you do it yourself.
Sometimes it's very excessive, or sometimes you go. Yeah. You know, they dug out the new trench for the new sewer line, and there's this
huge
pile of dirt all over the...
Which brings us to another problem. They're undermining the stability of the post and piers.
Yeah, quite often, yes. Yep.
I write that up all the time.
Yeah.
The trenching present. And so, yeah, a little tip for you guys, if you haven't come across this yet, it's when they trench out to replace that sewer lateral pipe underneath the house that connects to the city, typically they leave all the dirt on the side and they don't put it back. And if you look closely, a lot of times you'll see the concrete pier that's holding up that 4x4 wood support or 4x6. It's exposed, and big enough shake comes around that could lodge that loose, and then boom, you got a little settlement in the house. Right. So
don't forget all the empty beer cans left behind.
Yeah, the beer cans. Yeah, that too. it's never good when you find out your house was worked on a Friday when you see a bunch of Modelos under the house and whatever. Some Budweiser. Bud cans, right? Right, Bud?
Yeah.
So let's get off the beer subject. So that's about it for wood separation from soil. So it's not a good thing to have. And I'll go a step further real quick on that, and that is your fencing around your property. If it's all wobbly and fallen over and it's made out of wood, well, that's probably because you have wood to soil contact, which is a no-brainer. So as soon as you put a wood post in the dirt, it's doomed. It's
a time bomb.
It's a time bomb. It's just going to fail on you eventually. So that's something that happens on fencing all the time around houses, and people seem to get very concerned over that. And I just, well, you know, it's like building a set of stairs and letting them land in the grass. Yeah. You know, it's the same thing. It's just, it's not right. It's not built correctly, and it's not going to last. Okay, one last thing there, bud.
Yes, insulation.
Insulation and lack thereof, I like to call it. Insulation and lack thereof. California, do we really need insulation under our houses? Well, it depends on who you ask. If you ask an insulation company, I guarantee you they're going to tell you yes.
Well, I think it's a building code for newer construction.
Yes, newer construction, yes.
So a lot of times when we're, you know, inspecting a house that was built in the 50s and then had a master bedroom added in the 80s in the back, you go under, there's insulation underneath the new construction and not in the other house, other section. My understanding that floor insulation does not improve the energy efficiency that much.
Right.
Or it may not be. Now, in the attic, it's a great, you get your money back very easily.
Yes, attic for sure.
But floor, I'm not so sure. But you can always tell when English was a second language on people that installed insulation. Because on the way it works, on the fiberglass insulation, it has paper on one side and... that's supposed to be the vapor barrier. So you're supposed to put it up against the floor, and then the fiberglass hangs down. But it looks better if you put it the other way.
yeah,
looks cleaner. But that on all of it, it's all written, you know, caution, you know, do not leave this exposed because it's combustible material in a fire.
Installed backwards.
Yeah.
So I see it all the time.
Yeah. So I always take an extra picture of the caution sign when I do that.
Just, yeah. Yeah. So it's amazing how often I see that. Yeah, I'm sure you could say the same. You probably see it all the time.
I do. And there again, when they have it put in backwards, now if there's excess humidity underneath there, it's going to entrap that inside the fiberglass.
Yep. It's just wrong.
It is wrong. Now, another thing I'd like to say just with insulation is when you crawl in underneath the house and you start seeing the insulation dangling and pieces falling down, I've come to learn that indicates that at times there's excess humidity underneath the house because all that weights it down. It doesn't fall down on its own. It has to get
humidity. I see. It just gets heavier.
Heavier and heavier and starts falling down. So I look at that as, well, it's not hard to put it back up or look at it, but that's an indicate. It's a red flag saying, okay, this gets too humid underneath here, back to, and double check the ventilation around the house. And usually I'll find problems with lack of vents or restricted ventilation.
Right, right. So back to, so my opinion on the insulation is, you know, if it's an older structure before it was required, it's probably not going to be there unless somebody just wanted it added at one point. Like Bud said, something, a new addition, when it was required, it's going to have it. Most of the time I find a new addition, it has it. And then, but it's probably installed backwards. And it's, and then I look at the rest of the original structure and there's nothing there. So I just let my clients know, hey, there's no insulation. You might want to upgrade that if you're, you know, energy efficiency conscious. Some people are really into that and they really want to make sure everything's tightened up. So let me go over the, what the inspector is not required to determine or make a note on. And that would be determine the size, spacing, location, or adequacy of foundation bolting and bracing, components or reinforcing system. So how would you interpret that, Bud?
Well, there is an old geologist, Harvey, used to work here. I think he retired a few years ago. But he was a character, but I loved his saying. He used to say, it's performing, but it's not conforming. You know, he would go, you know, here's this, and he was a geologist, so the retaining wall. He goes, well, you know, it's not really build the code, you know, the codes, but
it's performing, but it's not conforming.
Yeah.
I'm going to try that this week.
But I always kind of like that in the sense of, you know, we're not engineers, so we can't go into a house and then go, well, this old house, you know, it's a good up to a 6.5 earthquake, but if it's 6.6, you're gonna, you know.
Yeah, don't get into that, anybody. That's
or
bad.
If it's bolting, is it adequately bolted? Is it adequately engineered?
Yeah, okay. Okay, here's a good one to add on to that.
Okay.
This happens on occasion. You'll get a realtor who really wants to quiz you on this stuff, and they'll keep asking you that same question over and over again. So is this structurally sound? Well, I'm not a structural engineer, so I can't answer that. 2 minutes later. So do you think the structure's okay? Once again, you got to learn how to deal with those kind of questions, and you got to stick to your guns on that. You got to just, hey, look, I can't comment on that. It's outside my scope of knowledge. I don't know how to answer that correctly, and I don't want to give you bad information. And they'll just keep on asking you. 10 minutes later, they'll come back at a different angle to ask you and try to put you on the spot, and I just look at them and shake my head.
Just the California Association of Realtors, different forms and guidelines.
I pointed one of those out in one of my last episodes.
Oh, and so when they're asking you about the structure and, you know, structural integrity of this place, you always refer them back to that. Well, you're supposed to recommend to the client to have a structural engineer if there's any questions.
Yeah.
sometimes I'll throw that back to them. You know, I go, well, you know, technically you're supposed to have it done. You know, in my opinion, everything right. seems to be performing and so forth. It's an older structure.
Right.
You know, I don't see any notable defects. I think that would handle that. And then the last one, not required by the inspector, is determine the composition or energy rating of insulation materials.
Right. So that translates to we're not required to know if you have a wall insulation under your house or if you have attic insulation in your wall or, you know, do you have, how what's the R value on my insulation, Mr. Inspector? Well, I don't know, unless it says it. If it says R13, I might see it and I may be able to mention it. But, well, it says R13 on the label. I'll look it up in the report and I'll let you know what I can find out. But you could say something like that, but just be careful with it. Don't tell them it's insulated properly, whatever you do, because you don't know. If you don't know, you don't know.
Right. And this is where codes change over the years, you know.
Right.
Like on new construction, you know, I'd have to look it up, but it might be 16 inches of blown in insulation.
Right.
Or, you know, whatever that R value is. So, you know, a house done in the 80s is you just have some 4-inch fiberglass battens rolled in. You know, that doesn't meet current standards.
Right, right. And here's another point, too. A lot of people are going to ask, oh, is that to code? Is this to code? They didn't read the inspection agreement at all because we're not there to report code. That's not what we're required to do. Am I wrong?
No, that's a whole subject unto itself.
Yeah, that's a whole subject unto itself. So we're not general home inspectors or generalists. We're not there to report code. We're there to report system defects. Now, if we see something that looks, that's not typically how you plumb a kitchen sink.
Right.
If we see something like that, of course, we're going to let you know. We have general knowledge of all the systems, but we're not there to report code. If you want to know if it's up to code, well, who installed it? Is there a receipt? Or did Uncle Bob, did the work?
Is there a permit?
Yeah, is there a permit? So that's why I always recommend if you see an upgrade, let the client know there's an upgrade present, something within a few years. I'll make a note of like that. If it's a brand new upgrade or within a few years old, I'll point it out, you know, you just check for permits.
So anyway, so when you talk about codes, it gets very complicated very fast.
Yes, it does. So just try to avoid that, guys, boys and girls.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not your job to do it. So don't try to play the hero because because you know the code on one thing, they may start asking you code on everything else. You know, and that's, you know, what's the point? Don't even go there.
Well, I do have a code book, but I keep it hidden in my backpack in the car, in the back seat.
Under the spare tire.
Yeah.
All right. So Bud, that's going to do it for this episode. Foundation, basement, and underfloor areas of the CREA standards of practice. And one thing I forgot to mention earlier when we started the podcast was, you know, you and I are both certified CREA inspectors.
Right.
I totally forgot to mention that. Just want to let people know that. So, but where did the standards come from? Did they come from CREA? Was there first or CREA was there first?
CREA is the oldest in the nation.
Okay.
So I know that we started this first, ASHI standards. I'd have to look at the history.
It's about 40 years ago, right?
Almost, yeah.
It was about 40 years, if I last heard correctly. It was about
early
40
80s,
years.
mid-80s.
Right.
Before my time.
Yeah.
So.
And CREA is recognized by the court system in California as a standard. That's something.
A lot of the laws are.
Yeah, that's something I've, our good old friend Greg Pyfrom has mentioned many times. Got to give him a call. I got to get him on the podcast.
Oh.
That would be very interesting. Pin him down and talk to him for an hour.
Oh, I might have to join you on that one just to keep him in his chair or something. And he's going to be speaking at our upcoming chapter meeting.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Well, then I'll make sure I'm there.
Okay.
All right, Bud, thanks for coming. And Bud's business name is?
Well, Hayes Inspection Group.
Hayes Inspection Group, but he's only one man.
That's right.
John here from Home Inspection Authority. Thanks, Bud. Great talking to you. I'm glad we got through this one section. And we plan on doing all the sections of the CREA Standards Practice. They'll just be in different episodes because we just don't know how in-depth we're going to get on each one. So this was episode 8 of the podcast. And this is going to be, what do you want to call this? Session 1? What should we call this?
Sure. CREA Standards.
CREA Standards Part 1. Oh, there you go. We're going to call this CREA Standards Part 1, Foundation, Basement, and Underfloor Areas. So once again, everybody, thanks for listening. Don't forget, I do have a YouTube channel. And we actually recorded this whole podcast on video with 3 cameras. So we're going to try to make a video out of this too. So hopefully my editor can put it all together. And we'll get them both out there as soon as we can. Take care.
Thank you.